Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this Lear Report. This is John Titus and Catherine Austin Fitz. We're recording on Wednesday, February 22nd for publication tomorrow, Thursday, February 22nd. And our theme, John, is?
The chickens come home to roost.
Whoa. Everywhere you look. Everywhere you look. It's, you know, I keep driving down the road thinking, you know, my mother was right.
Maybe. Yeah, I tell you who else was right was John Perkins. You know, when he came out, he did Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and he did a revised edition later on, kind of recently, within the last 10 years. The original came out in 1980 or so. And he said in the revised edition, he says, listen, all those hitman tricks that we used overseas are coming back to the U.S. They're going to be used here.
Right. I did write an article accusing him of modified hangout because he said there was no greater conspiracy. I don't know if you remember that from the first book. I think he might have changed by the second. Anyway.
No. Yeah. But he got that. He got that much right. The chickens are coming home to roost.
Here's the thing. When he wrote the first book and the second book, those tactics were well underway throughout the United States already.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. He was kind of maybe he was pointing out the obvious, but he had been so right in the Confessions of an Economic Hitman about what was going on and taking down leaders overseas that we didn't like.
Right.
And it's like, look what's happening now.
Well, we saw it during the pandemic. Remember the five African leaders who got taken down, you know, I think one or two by election, but the rest by assassination.
That's Hitman 1980. But then Hitman 2008, I think it was. He said, you know, we're going to take down leaders here and look, we're going to have a story this week on that very thing.
Right.
In the U.S.
It looks to me like we're taking down every one of them.
Everyone that the powers that be find disagreeable.
I know. But the ones that they find agreeable can't walk up the stairs.
Can't walk up the stairs. Right. They can't complete a sentence.
Right.
Right. That's fine. A leader like that's fine. And then you've got your late night talk show host to say, oh, don't worry. Everything's normal. Biden's great. He's a genius.
Somebody said that?
No, I'm just saying, just try the pitch on mainstream media and big old media is everything's fine. Don't trust your lying eyes. They're not to be believed. Don't believe yourself. Trust the experts. Biden's just fine. We don't need any cognitive tests. Don't you worry.
I don't know, when a special prosecutor says you're too senile to stand trial, you got a problem.
that's the hint. I mean, he's like, listen, Joe, you need to go. Okay, how are we going to do this? Easy or rough? You going to go like a good boy, or are we going to take you out?
Well, but here's the thing. They got to replace Kamala Harris first.
You know what? Have to is not in the that doesn't apply to these guys. That implies there's some sort of boundary restraint or law that can rein criminals in, and there is not.
I don't know. They got an optics problem. Okay, let's dive in.
They got a big time optics problem, but they don't have a legal restraint problem. Okay, let's go to genocide in Gaza, and it's just business as usual over there. Business as usual throughout the Middle East, really. The first is from Celia Farber. There's a massacre unfolding right now in Nasser Hospital. Masses of patients, children, men, and women are being slain indiscriminately. Of course, this is coming after the ICJ has said, okay, yes, Israel is a genocidal state. They're guilty of genocide. There's a very good case for genocide going on over there. And then right back to business as usual. Let's just cut to the chase down here. The Israeli military, which used drones and loudspeakers to tell people to leave Nasser Hospital, so they know they're targeting the hospital, said it opened a secure route to allow civilians to exit while medics and patients could remain inside. However, those sheltering inside were afraid to leave after reports that people were shot on their way out. The Israeli army also fired on people inside the hospital, including a doctor and a nurse. Color me unsurprised. And the U.S. is doing nothing to rein this in except yammering.
Right. The U.S. could stop this anytime they want.
Of course.
They're not going to.
Of course. We'll get to what happens when the U.S. support withers up in Ukraine in just a minute. But let's keep it going with the Red Sea and what's going on with Yemen. This is another business as usual. Oh, look at this. Houthi rebels' attack severely damages a Belize-flagged ship. We'll get to talk about that in a minute. In a key strait leading to the Red Sea. Okay, so we're in the Red Sea area. A missile attack by Yemen's Houthi rebels that damaged a Belize-flagged ship. This ship, it might have had a Belize flag, but the owner, the registered owner, is in Britain. So that's why it was flagged. Traveling through a strait connecting Red Sea and the Gulf has forced the crew to abandon the vessel, authorities said Monday. I think it eventually sank. The Houthis also claim they shot down an American MQ-9 Reaper drone. This part's interesting here. The British-registered Lebanese-operated cargo ship had been on its way to Bulgaria after leaving in the United Arab Emirates. The Houthis also later identified the ship as the Ruby Mar, as did the U.S. military's Central Command. How did they find this information out? Well, if you look at this, ship tracking data from marinetraffic.com. So not a particularly arcane source, right, from a website. And this cuts again to what's going on with asymmetric warfare. A Reaper drone is about $30 million. A bulk cargo ship of the size we're talking about there, they start at about $25 million. And they're getting taken out by $2,000, $3,000 drones based on information these guys are gleaning from the internet. This has completely changed warfare, and Yemen's got it all over the U.S. and the U.K. and the Red Sea.
So if you look at what drives the U.S. channel, so the power of the U.S. channel, it's the policing of the sea lanes and the policing of the satellite lanes. And if the brand goes out that the U.S. can't police the sea lanes or it can't police them economically, it's got a real problem.
Yeah, right.
So what it's saying is your model is not working. And it's funny because military analysts predicted this many years ago, that the economics of drones and other kinds of small footprint technology would wreak havoc with the model.
Right, because even if you have a 10-to-1 or even a 100-to-1 advantage, we just saw that the advantage for the rebels over there is 1,000-to-1 in terms of economics.
Right.
You got to spend $30 million to deal with, you know, basically a 30,000 or maybe even 10,000-to-1, a $3,000 drone or whatever they're using. It's not expensive.
Right. And the political problem the U.S. military has is they are in a situation where it's the big acquisitions that generate the jobs and the big contracts and the big stock market profits.
That's another way of looking at this. It's like, well, that is a success from the U.S. point of view because $30 million is $30 million in a Reaper drone. Having it get shot out of the sky is just another opportunity to make another $30 million for us. Win.
Right. But ultimately, those economics don't work. So you've got political pressure to do big footprint, but winning says you got to get great at little footprint.
Yeah.
Right.
And does the U.S. have the first clue about how to do that?
Well, here's the thing. Generals that do big footprint are the guys who get promoted.
Right.
Right?
Of course.
Right.
Yeah. That's the problem in this system now.
So last night on Ask Catherine, we got a question about Treasury Direct and how to go about doing Treasury Direct. And did we delight Treasury Direct? And I said, sure, if you want to finance Ukraine and Gaza and, you know, whatever. But if you like big footprint, go to Treasury Direct and give them some more of your money. I mean, it's our pension funds that are doing this.
Yeah. But, you know, my question is, what's your alternative?
Oh, there are plenty of alternatives. There are plenty of alternatives. Look, when we get to the chart on treasuries are down 30% since the going direct reset. That's not
that's true. That much is true. That chart is an eye opener.
Right.
Okay. But let's keep it going with Ukraine. Because it's not business as usual there. Things are not going well for Ukraine. Avdiivka is over. And that was a big point of resistance. We've covered this a couple times, Avdiivka. That was a real big battle. Now Ukraine's done over there.
This article is very hard to read.
It is
very hard to read.
So I'm gonna cut right to it, which is here. It's over. units of the 3rd Brigade filmed themselves, 3rd Brigade of Ukraine, filmed themselves leaving Avdiivka towards the west. Their U.S.-made M113 armored aluminum can is driving at high speed. It comes under fire. They're passing the sign here that 2 months ago, there's Zelensky filming himself. Welcome to Avdiivka sign. In December was the background of his selfie stunt with, on the entrance to Avdiivka. Look at this. I want you to watch this video real quick. It's real short. There we go. I'm going to go to whole screen. He's got a U.S. flag on his helmet. It's the first thing to notice. And then, here you go. There's the sign.
Looks like they're going as fast as they can.
Yeah, right. They're getting their hauling out. They're out of there. They're not waiting around for that one. But any question about the fall of Avdiivka, here you go. Let's cut again to it. This is Wikipedia. This is after it happened. The Battle of Avdiivka was a major battle between Russia. It's over. Well, you know, nothing says it's over like a Wikipedia entry. Right.
I don't trust Wikipedia on controversial things. I trust them on non-controversial, but not on controversial.
Okay. I'd put that in the white flag category. It's over.
Right.
You know, and this is, a lot of people will say, well, you know, that's, they're going to now hold this out as, oh, well, we see this wouldn't have happened if we had funded Ukraine. And there may be some truth in that. It wouldn't have fallen that fast, but it was going to fall. Because we had shown a video months ago predicting this very outcome, that Russia would eventually win. And the video showed was that the skies over Avdiivka were being patrolled exclusively by Russian craft. No Ukrainian craft in sight.
So I can't find another logical conclusion other than the neocons want to run the drains, you know, the drain scenario, but in the process they want to depopulate the Ukraine. They have to know that you're just basically going to steadily wipe out the army. And the question for me is, how do they keep the Ukrainians fighting?
That's a good question, but they're all in on this. And I think we'll see that in a story later in Farmageddon. I mean, there's been some bad discoveries by Russia over there. There's a lot of bad evidence for the very people who are.
They cannot afford transparency about what's been going on in the Ukraine for the last 20 years.
All bad.
Right.
All bad. Now, that said, you just saw Israel flout an international, you know, court of justice ruling that's committing genocide, and they're continuing to commit genocide. I can't imagine the U.S. wouldn't do the same thing. They're just going to ignore. They're going to keep doubling down. The neocons in the U.S. power structure has one move. It's a one-trick pony. It's right. Like pick a strategy and then double down. I saw this in litigation a long time ago. I'm like, what is this strategy where you just keep repeating the same lies that we just ripped the face off of in open court? And they'd come back. It's like, did you hear what the judge said? It's like this double down. Robots.
Right. Well, they clearly believe the drain strategy can work on Russia.
Clearly.
Right.
Yeah. And it's not working.
It is working if you look at cost of capital and how much money their syndicate is making this year. In other words, double down works if what you care about is how much money you claw out this year.
Okay. But there's two sides of that coin, which is the next story shows this.
Right.
So let's cut to this. This is more Ukraine. Remember all the big powerful U.S. sanctions? Oh, we're gonna stop Russia. Our sanctions are gonna crush Russia. CNN. The Kremlin has never been richer, thanks to a U.S. strategic partner. Thanks to the U.S. Russia is entering its third year of the war in Ukraine with an unprecedented amount of cash in government coffers, bolstered by a record $37 billion of crude oil sales to India last year. That's the strategic partner that CNN's complaining about, according to a new analysis, which concludes that some of the crude was refined by India and then exported to the United States as oil products worth more than $1 billion. So Yeah, I guess the money's falling across the board. The U.S. is richer and Russia's richer, too.
Yeah, but the sanctions have put in place all sorts of mechanisms that improve financial transaction control.
I've yet to see that.
Well, the question...
I've heard that. We had looked at that claim last week, but there was no proof of it.
I believe it. I'm looking for the mechanism, so I'll drill down.
Okay. All right, let's turn to FedWatch, and the let's lead off with... This is a Dutch parliamentarian talking about the climate crisis. His summary is so good. I'm not going to play the whole thing. It's two and a half minutes or so, but I'll get enough of it.
A huge prejudice. I love the Dutch people. I always say the Dutch are the Swiss in a good mood. They're such great people. Anyway, go ahead. This is a perfect example.
Yeah. I love this guy's forthrightness. It's perfect.
Okay. The bureaucrats centralist in Brussels are addicted to power. They use or they abuse every crisis. Financial crisis, COVID crisis, Ukraine crisis, energy crisis. And the solution is always the same. And the professor already said it, more European Union. If there's no crisis, and that's the second point, if there's no crisis, they create crisis. For example, climate change. They call it an existential threat. And the solution is the Green Deal. The Green Deal destroyed our energy system. It is destroying our food system. They are trying to control CO2. But if you control CO2, you control people, because everything we do in life is about CO2 emissions, living, breathing, eating, traveling, living. So if you can control that, you can control people's lives. Now they introduce the digital identity and the central bank digital currency. So they can see everything we do, and they can control everything we do, because they can shut off our financial system whenever they want. We have seen it already in Canada during the COVID crisis.
Okay. I love my favorite part of that clip is the cameraman. As soon as he starts in on climate change is a fraud, the cameraman's like, no. We got to back out of that. We'll zoom way out, like five times out. And then he starts talking about, you can control everything with digital identity and did the CBDC. The camera's like, I like that. Control. It's like, was Augustin Carstens your cameraman? It kind of seemed like it.
So... It's one of the things that was really interesting in the Putin interview with Tucker Carlson. Carlson asks about the Nord Stream pipeline, and Putin says to Tucker, "You blew it up," meaning the U.S. And Tucker said, "I didn't blow it up." But then Lavrov comes back with a really excellent speech where he talks about, essentially the Americans blowing up the Nord Stream. And I bring that up not because that is necessarily common knowledge, but among the leadership in Europe, it's common knowledge. And once you have that knowledge, you realize, okay, we're being composted. Our industry is being destroyed, to benefit the U.S. And I think that, Ruse and a lot of these other guys realize, okay, this cabal that's doing Ukraine, that's doing Gaza, that's doing all of this, are basically destroying Europe, so that they can get their way. The double down includes composting Europe.
So just to back up, Ruzan is the Dutch parliamentarian we saw in that clip?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is the leaders understand now what the game is, and they know they're on the menu, and their countries are on the menu, and their people are on the menu. What we're watching...
And they're not doing anything about it because they're getting paid?
The ones who are pushing are trying to do something about it, and they're trying to figure out what they can do about it.
So it's not all European leaders who would share that view, at least not openly.
Oh, I think I think a lot share that view. They don't know how to share it. They're not going to share it openly, and they're trying to figure out where their personal advantage is. Where is the place I can get out of being on the menu and get into the insider? So right. You got a whole bunch of people who want to be insiders and play ball, you know, and make money with the insiders going along with wrecking their countries. And then you've got a bunch of guys who are trying to figure out what to do about it.
Right. So in other words, there's not really a material difference between European leadership and U.S. leadership.
There is a very material difference because in the U.S., the states and the sheriffs have real power legally that you don't have.
But not the leadership at the federal level, not congressional leadership.
Well,
they're going along. They're going right along.
No, I think the leaders in the federal government are leaving so that they can fight Washington.
But if they're leaving, then by definition, they're no longer part of the power structure.
Depending on where they go.
Okay. But again, I'm talking about at the congressional level.
Right.
But they're doing the same thing EU is doing.
So the congressman in Western Tennessee is saying he's not running for Congress again. He's going to come back and run for governor.
Right.
Or the rumor is he's going to run for governor. I'm pretty sure he's going to run for governor. And that's because he thinks he can get more done as governor than he can as a congressman.
Right. And he may be right about that and probably is. However, he is no longer, again, by definition, in Congress if he leaves.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Right. So it's a congressional leadership in the U.S. They're doing the same thing.
Right.
I mean, let's be blunt. I mean, the Congress is a traitorous organization that's selling the U.S. down the river because, like Zelensky, they got a $20 million mansion in Miami or whatever inducement they need.
Not everyone is, but the ones who are not traitorous have been leaving or are leaving because, you know, their enemy is Washington. Same reason I left. Washington right. was my enemy. You can't, you know, in a group of people who are centralizing power, you can't decentralize within that mechanism. You have to.
Right. Leave. Exactly. Exactly.
So, you know, here's how it works. There's this great line. Did you ever watch Dallas? Somehow no. You seem way too intelligent to have watched Dallas. When I was on Wall Street, did watch Dallas.
I struggled for a minute to remember what Dallas was. Dallas? So I thought, Larry Hagman, we were better in I Dream a Genie, Larry. What are we doing?
I used to go to Broadway to the theater, and during intermission, people would talk about what's happening in Dallas this week. But anyway, there's this great scene in Dallas when one son, Bobby, is complaining about second son, JR, to his dad, Jacques. And Jacques turns to him in disgust and he says, boy, nobody gives you power. You take it. Okay. Yeah. So if you're going to decentralize, you got to leave Washington and take. There's nothing you can get done in Washington. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Fair enough. Okay. Let's continue in FedWatch with a paper, sort of a piece out from a JP Morgan strategist. And we'll just can't cover all these things, but we'll touch on a few. Top 10 surprises in 2024 in honor of Byron Wine. I don't know who that is.
He was a strategist. He used to give, you know, his top 10 every year. So
okay. So now we have, in his honor, here's my list of top 10 surprises from another analyst. Okay. Number one, U.S. dollar remains stable. Okay. That's not a biggie.
I agree with that one.
I do too. That's not really hard to go along with, given the charts. This one, though, this is interesting. It's quite specific. Biden withdraws sometime between Super Tuesday, which is like March 2nd, it's right around the corner, and the November election, citing health reasons. Biden passes the torch to a replacement candidate named by the DNC. Is he right?
I give this 80% chance or better.
Yeah.
And the problem is nobody can figure out what the replacement candidate is. So
right. Right. We'll see. But I think that one's on the money. Okay. Let's go to the next.
If, however, Hillary Clinton, Trump wins in a landslide, I don't care what they do to it.
Yeah. Right. 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 I guess I'm going to focus on sort of what I would consider kind of the long shot bets from a conventional point of view. Here's another one. Number seven, Russia invasion of Ukraine drags on with no ceasefire in 2024.
I'm sure of that. You know, it's funny. It's you could both when you listen to the latest from Putin and Lavrov, how do you make a deal with somebody who won't make a deal and you can't trust to keep their word? In other words, the Americans are not agreement capable. The neocons think the drain strategy will work. They need to keep pumping money for a variety of reasons, some related to Ukraine, some not. Why would anybody stop doing what they're doing?
Right. I think that's right. I don't think Russia's, like we said, no sudden moves on Russia's part. I think this is going to drag on a long time. We said that from day one back in February of 2022. This is going to be around a long, long time because people benefit from it.
So this is trench warfare. But if you were the Russians, what would you do?
I'd just keep pressing on.
So you keep turtling forward? You'd take more turf? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No sudden moves. You don't want to make a sudden move around a guy like Lindsey Graham. Okay, that's a bad idea.
Right. So you just inch your way forward.
Yep, of course. Yep. Keep collecting that evidence, which we'll get to in a minute. But let's go to the last J.P. Morgan prediction. Despite storm clouds over U.S. regional banks, their stocks will do well in 2024 with stable or rising price to book values. I don't think there really are storm clouds over regional banks.
There never were, other than...
Yeah. But I think that this is right, and we'll get to that, why they're doing well, in another story. But I think I agree. I'm with them on that prediction. There were never problems with the regional banks ever.
Right.
That was another fake story.
Right.
So that's from J.P. Morgan, which is kind of surprising.
It doesn't surprise me because buried within the infrastructure, they do have economists and market strategists who try and deal with reality. You know, I told you the story of Jamie Dimon's assistant years ago who called Skidmore to ask him about the missing money story, not realizing since J.P. Morgan Chase owns the depository and is a lead agent for the depository, all the illegal many of the illegal transactions went through J.P. Morgan Chase. And the financing, the primary dealer functions that was financing the illegal transactions went through J.P. Morgan Chase. He didn't seem to be aware of that. You know, but
was he 22 years old?
He was early 20s.
Yeah.
I don't remember what age, but he was young. Yeah. Skidmore called me and he said, can this really happen? I said, yeah, they don't know. You know, everybody's on a need to know basis. They don't know.
Yeah, right. It's information siloing. And you don't need to know if you're a snuffy at age 22 or whatever.
Right, but you'll find parked away, particularly in the strategists, the portfolio strategists or the economist shops, you'll find people who are really, really smart and do very interesting research, but they have awesome resources. When I built Hamilton Securities, my resources to do research were just glorious. They were wonderful, and that's why they were destroyed. So
yeah. Okay, I want to touch on one aspect of J.P. Morgan's read on Biden right here. It's a new poll from Rasmussen. I'm not going to show the poll itself, but most judge Biden's presidency a failure. And so look at these numbers. You have 40% of likely voters believe his term in office has been successful, counterbalanced by 40% who deem it a complete failure. The balance of people, though, 58%, view the presidency as unsuccessful. So this is the mama bear porridge. It's just right in the middle. 58% is Biden's unsuccessful. That's a devastating poll.
He's got to go. I mean, the reason I believe he's going to go before the election is they can't afford to lose. I don't care how many immigrants they allow to vote. They're going to lose.
Yeah. That special counsel's report is the torpedo in the side of the Biden campaign. He's done.
Right.
Yeah. He got poleaxed there.
Right.
Even as they were doing him a favor, like, I can't really prosecute the guy, but we can ruin his campaign because he's a moron.
Right.
You know, that was rough. But we can't prosecute him because he's senile. That was the report.
Here's the problem. The Democrats don't have anybody decent to step in there. I mean, if you.
They don't. But, you know, it's a marketing campaign. Push anything. They push the Russian disinformation for 3 years. They'll push anything, however ridiculous.
Well, if you look at the latest UK poll, you know, Putin would win.
Wow.
Serious.
Yeah.
They did a poll in the UK and they said, who do you want to be the prime minister? You know, Sunak, Mark Carney, or, you know, some of the other, David Cameron and Putin. It was like 90% Putin wanted Putin.
That's in the UK. This is U.S. election. They don't say there's no candidate. They They've got a cadaver as a guy right now, and they're pushing him as a.
Here's the problem. 20 years ago, you could get some really gifted, talented people who would be willing to play the role if you back them. Those people don't want to be president now.
Right. But if do you think, I mean, let's say they bump Gavin Newsom, just to pick an example, at the front.
Right.
Okay. What do you think the women on The View are going to say, he's not qualified. He's they're going to love the guy, right?
Right.
And 30 million people are going to watch that.
Right.
The propaganda machine is going to go into overdrive with whoever they pick.
I agree, and that can buy them some support. But, you know, I remember the day when candidates truly inspired. It wasn't just the corporate media behind them. They had something more than mind control. So I'm not saying mind control and corporate support can't get Newsom a certain distance. But if you remember the good old true inspiration around a candidate, it's flat. It's dead. Newsom can't inspire anybody.
Yeah, right. But he doesn't need to. That's not what we're talking about. It's just.
Well, if you can rig all the elections, sure. You can't.
Hey, we could rig all the elections.
Well, here's the impunity. Problem. Red states can rig them for the red guys, and the blue states can rig them for the blue guys, and then you're going to get a real tear in the fact.
I think the criminal calculation at the top is all you really need is an edifice of plausibility with right. shows like The View or ABC News or Stephanopoulos, whoever.
I agree.
You just need that veneer of plausibility and a vote that's, you know, in your favor, which is 51 right. to 50.
But if you look at this way, the chickens are coming home to roost, that's not working on the ground because reality, people are dealing with reality on the ground.
If that Rasmussen poll would suggest that. That's not a good poll. That's right. why Biden's going to go.
Right.
Anyway, but don't think that the next shiny new toy isn't going to undo those results. It will.
Okay.
We don't know.
See anybody in the. Let's see.
I don't see
anybody in the red states going for the shiny new toy that these guys come up with on the Democratic side. I just don't.
Here's what we will see, though. Let's go to the next story. This is definitely happening. Non-citizens may soon be cops and firefighters. From the American Military News, Denver is considering an initiative to change the city charter to allow non-citizens to serve as police officers and firefighters, which would allow immigrants with work authorization to be hired for both public safety positions. Currently, the Sheriff's Department there is authorized to hire non-citizens due to a federal settlement from 2016 that determined that Denver had discriminated against work-authorized immigrants. All it did was it authorized the hire, probably mandated the hire, though. Anyway, that's kind of an interesting take on why Denver is going to be hiring non-citizen to run the fire department and police department.
Okay, so what you're saying is BS. If they wanted U.S. citizens, all they have to do is raise their salaries. This is very simple. If you look at how much money Denver and the Denver governmental corporations have wasted, hundreds of billions of dollars on all sorts of stuff, I assure you, if they wanted Americans, they could simply raise their prices and do the kind of special recruitment they need to do to get it, okay? So I don't buy the story. It's complete BS. The other thing I will say is if my jurisdiction was going to do this, I would fight it and stop it, or I would pick up my business and my home and my residence and my family, and I would leave that jurisdiction. Period.
Yeah.
Discussion.
Yeah.
I have no idea what this is. You can't. What this means is we can bring in mercenaries. And they will do whatever we want, and you're right.
They won't hesitate to pull a Kent State and shoot Americans.
Right.
They won't not even hesitate.
I think there are a lot of immigrants who wouldn't do that. You know, they go through training and they wouldn't want to do that. That's not who they're bringing in.
Training where? Training in Israel? They'd do it.
Yeah, they're not bringing in some guy from Mexico who wants a chance for him and his family to have a better life and is glad to get a great job and will be conscientious, who's a serious Catholic. That's not who they're bringing in.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. consider the likely scenario? The rags to riches guy from Mexico, or are we going to hire the guy we're bringing in from, you know, where, or Chechnya, who's been trained in Israel to shoot Americans?
You know, there you go.
What do you think is more likely? Anyway, let's turn to this next title is pretty interesting. The Kafka-esque Trump trial. This case just makes me shake my head. Like, I'm glad I don't practice law that much anymore. I still practice, but it's not that much. This, by the way, this piece is from Reason by this Stephen Calabresi, who I think is a professor at Northwestern Law School. He doesn't like Trump. He's not a Trump fan. He's like anti-Trump. I was stunned when I read this. President Trump's Kafka-esque civil trial in New York State. So Trump's been ordered to pay a $355 million fine and been barred from doing business in New York for 3 years. So have his sons, Donald and Eric, have also been fined, and they are barred from doing business for 2 years. Now, Ivanka and Melania could legally run the Trump business for the next 2 years, but the judge appointed a retired U.S. District Judge Barbara Jones to continue in her role as independent monitor on the Trump businesses. And the judge said, go ahead and micromanage those businesses. This is punishment. That's all of this is punishment for Trump allegedly committing fraud, okay, by falsely inflating and deflating the value of his real estate assets to receive favorable loans from the bank. However, not a single bank claimed it had been defrauded by Trump. They're like, yeah, we're on the side. We give more loans. And Calabresi says, This is a new law that really hadn't been litigated before, never before used. New York State penalty has been twisted into a tool for a grossly excessive fine and, more seriously, the completely inappropriate appointment of Judge Jones to micromanage the Trump business, which she is not competent to do, and to even order the dissolution of Trump businesses in New York State. Just so far beyond the pale of James, the attorney general there in New York, and the judge have essentially turned a vaguely worded New York state law into a modern-day bill of attainder targeted at Donald Trump. This right here, vaguely worded, is probably, for my money, why that statute's going down. It's unconstitutionally vague. You can't just say, well, we got a law against bad guys. That's what this is. Trump's a bad guy. Here's what we're going to do. No way does this hold up.
So this is the kind of thing I saw in Washington during the 90s. And the 2000s, you know, it turns the law into a joke. It's just it's a judge that says I can make up the law, and you know, and
right. I'm the king. I can do anything.
Yeah, I'm the king. I can do anything. Perfect. That's exactly what it is, and the important thing to understand is the judge, because he's in New York, thinks he has the support of the New York infrastructure. And I'm assuming it's the financial institutions to do this. So he's got serious political support behind him if he's doing this. Judges don't go this far, you know, outside the law and act like king unless they've got real political support for it. And, you know, it's the same thing you and I discuss again and again and again. If there's no law, we're all toast. Now, here's what's funny. States have the power, John, to say, you know, we withdraw your license to operate in this jurisdiction because you have not behaved like a good citizen. Now, a sophisticated real estate developer, you know, running his balance sheet up and down with sophisticated banks who understand that real estate and can check everything, you know, that's like saying I defrauded you because you didn't understand litigation or something. That's ridiculous.
Right.
So no, you know, there may be games here, but they're games between two sophisticated parties who play games with each other, and the banks can say no.
There's no damages. It's victimless.
Right. This is a total nothing burger. Okay. So this is in a state that has permitted felons to operate. You know, so Pfizer creates felonies that kill people. JP Morgan Chase creates felonies that kill people. That's not a problem. They can continue to operate in New York.
Oh, yeah.
But Donald Trump can't.
HSBC can launder money for drug dealers and terrorists in Brooklyn.
Right.
No problem. No problem at all. Go right ahead. We'll fine you, but you just keep doing it. And they had a monitor too, but the monitor just rubber stamped everything that HSBC did.
The problem is this is not just lawless. The hypocrisy relative to the, you know, to the criminality they're supporting and tolerating basically said, you know, New York is basically our model is criminals. We're a criminal enterprise and we support criminal enterprises and we make this state safe for criminal enterprises. And, you know, Donald Trump is threatening some of those criminal enterprises. So we're going to destroy him. And there's no law.
I think the judge's calculation might have been different. I don't think he needed the political support. I think the judge's calculation was, I got time on my side. It's February. I entered this judgment, $355 million. By the time Trump gets it teed up and up in front of the Supreme Court, it'll be after the election. It's too late. And I can save the day with a Trump defeat by harming him financially.
So many years ago, somebody wanted me to sign a confidentiality to look at a private placement. And I agreed I would. And they were in New Zealand. They sent me the document. And instead of it being under New Zealand law, it was under New York law. And I sent it back and I said, I refuse to sign it. There is no law in New York.
Right. There's probably a clause that said it'll be arbitrated privately in New York, too.
Said, I'm not signing this.
No.
I won't sign anything under New York law. No. Anyway, so I don't, you know, here's the problem. Successful financial markets need law. And the question is, you decide there is no law in New York and New York is a lawless place and you can't trust them. They're not agreement capable. You know, they do Madoff, they do Epstein, but, you know, they throw Donald Trump out.
Yeah, right.
I got to tell you, Madoff and Epstein were worse than Donald Trump, right?
Yeah, right. So as HSBC, they had no problem at all.
Exactly. No.
Okay, let's keep it going in FedWatch. This next story is pretty big. It's from Children's Health Defense. Mm-hmm. Concerns fluoride. Let me just start by saying, you know, most lawsuits, it's just, you know, it's Smith versus Jones, okay? It's two private parties. It's two balance sheets at stake. It's, you know, is Smith going to have to transfer money to Jones or vice versa?
Right.
That's it. That's not this next case. This next case is big. Let's cut to it. EPA's final witness concede fluoride's harm, admit to flaws in key study as trial closes. Let's get right to a U.S. EPA risk assessor admitted fluoride is neurotoxic at relatively low levels. It's kind of the headline, but it gets a lot worse for the EPA. It is now, and this underscores the scope of this case. It is now up to Judge Chen in the Northern District of California, the federal judge, to decide if the EPA should be required to create a rule banning water fluoridation in the U.S. This is what makes this a big case. This isn't Smith versus Jones. This is the EPA with a very big rule. Let's go into the details of the case. On cross-examination, the plaintiff's attorney, Connett, forced Barone, who's the EPA's expert, to concede several of the plaintiff's key points. Question, you do not dispute that fluoride is capable of causing neurodevelopment harm, correct? Connett asked. Answer, I do not, Barone said. That's devastating, but it gets worse. Water fluoridation levels in the U.S. are currently 0.7 parts per million, also referred to as milligrams per liter. Barone, the EPA expert on the EPA side, also conceded that this report, the National Toxicology Protocol Report, or whatever it is, practice report, the NTP report linking fluoride to neurotoxicity at 1.5 milligrams per liter is a rigorous, high-quality review, and that the NTP is one of the world leaders in doing such reviews. So even though the current standard is 0.7, in reality, the level is at 1.5. That's what they're saying. Question, are you comfortable then with a pregnant woman having so much fluoride in her circulating system that her kidney has lost the ability to efficiently process it? Barone, the expert, get this, sits in silence for several seconds before responding. Again, putting this in context, my comfort level, I don't think is germane. So he's asked, are you comfortable telling pregnant women to do this? And he's like, I don't think my comfort level is germane. That's a devastating loss for the EPA. That's as good as saying I'm not comfortable with it. Then that's how the judge is going to read it.
So the U.S. government and governments have been using fluoride for years to poison people. And my understanding is fluoride helps lower IQs. So understand, this is a very But here's the little magic secret here. If you look at how much it costs a county to put fluoride in the water, it's very expensive. And an automatic municipal saving, you want to save a couple hundred thousand dollars or more, millions in your jurisdiction, take the information from this trial, go down to your city council or county government and insist they stop right now. But grab that $500,000 or whatever the money in the budget is and shift it into something you want to see happen. So there's a huge amount of money being wasted on paying for fluoride in counties in America.
Yeah, that's a great point.
It's an opportunity.
And there's a lot more to this in that article. I just kind of touched on the highlights saying, look, things are not going well for the EPA and it's a big deal.
So it's been very difficult for years when I've tried to talk people into protecting themselves from fluoride. I have really had trouble coming up with great information to give them. And this trial and the big CHD just came out with a big documentary on fluoride has really, really helped. And this is an enormous contribution by CHD to help with this. So, yeah. So the material, the documentation and material is now there for you to go down to your county or city council and get this stopped. And it was interesting at the Rogersville panel, we had a lot of discussion about, you know, from an activist who's been trying to get fluoride stopped in Tennessee. And Frank nicely talked about one county where they were able to get it stopped. But then they took the remaining fluoride they had in inventory, and it turned out it was a hazardous waste, so they weren't allowed to put it in the landfill. So instead, they had to keep running it through the water until they were rid of it.
Wow.
Wow.
I'll say this about this case, too. You know, it's pending. It's in the Northern District of California, and that Judge Chen is a name I recognize. And the reason is I do patent litigation. And patent litigation is enormously complicated and a lot of technical details. And Chen here is on top of this case. He's perfectly comfortable with the details. He's very engaged. He's asking questions. Northern District of California is one of the, to me, for my money, the two best districts to litigate a patent case. If you want a judge who's engaged and smart and they're not afraid to jump in with detail. Yeah, Northern District of California, because of Silicon Valley. A lot of cases are out there.
Right.
Yeah, Northern District of California would be number two. Number one would be Delaware.
Right.
Because it's you have more certainty. There's only four district court judges in Delaware, four or five.
On the mortgage fraud side, the worst was Central California. But California on the mortgage fraud was just.
Yeah, Central California and Southern, that's a different ball of wax. So the Northern District of California in San Francisco, Palo Alto, that's.
You got the brainy guys.
Okay. It's pretty good. Yeah. Yeah. And the EPA is in trouble. That testimony is. That's a bad. They had a bad day that day. When he sits there for 10 seconds and doesn't answer the question, and then gives an answer that doesn't answer the question.
Well, the EPA is in trouble because their experts just proved they've been poisoning people for decades.
Yeah.
Intentionally.
Yep. Right? Yep. Okay, let's keep it going with commercial real estate. Not looking good in CRE. They're staring down $929 billion of maturities this year. I'm not really concerned about the jump of 40% over a forecast, but there's other jumps that are serious.
So the one thing I will say, when I was in Washington, the Mortgage Bankers Association was pretty reliable on statistics. I'm assuming they still are.
Yeah, but they got a jump over a forecast. Like, yeah, so what? The forecast sucked.
Not really.
But that there's more in this than just forecast. Okay. That's what I'm saying. The writer leads off with the forecast. Forecast is BS. Forget the forecast. Look at this. This is what you focus on.
Yep.
Almost 20% of the country's outstanding commercial debt is maturing this year. Okay. One in five of every commercial debt. That's a number I can get my head around. How about this? Commercial property prices are down 21% since early 2022, according to Green Street, including a 35% decrease in office prices. Okay. That's another number I understand. That's not a forecast. That's real.
Right. Right.
And it's real ugly.
Right. So I've been driving around, talking to real estate brokers. They're very concerned about this.
Those are eye-opening numbers. In other words, so one-fifth of your debt is going to roll over at a time when your asset values are down. You don't think they're going to reassess the value of the collateral of that loan when they roll over the debt?
Right.
When you come to renegotiate?
it's one thing if you're, you know, when you're in Tennessee, people are pouring into Tennessee. They are pouring into it. The economy relative to any place in the country is booming. If you're in a place where everybody's trying to get out, like Chicago, you know, it's the, or a place where they're playing these games with the cops, Louisiana or Minneapolis, you know, you got to, the cabal is in there buying cheap. They're getting cheap.
Yeah. Right. They are. Right. They are. Man.
I'll occasionally get through the grapevine sort of offers of great real estate deals. You know, if you want to play follow the leader with the cabal that you can pick up in the places where they're killing the cops. So.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. That would be interesting to track that.
They're accumulating.
Okay, let's keep it going. Let's shift gears to Farmageddon, with chickens come home to roost. This next story is just, this is tragic, and it's so bad on so many levels. 19-year-old son of former YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki found dead at UC Berkeley. It's heartbreaking. So there's Wojcicki, the mom. Marco Troper, the son of former CEO of YouTube, Susan Wojcicki, has died. He was 19 years old. He was a freshman. A freshman at UC Berkeley's campus was found unresponsive on Tuesday afternoon at his dormitory. Let's go to some quotes from his grandma. No quotes from his mom. Troper's grandmother, Esther Wojcicki, believes the Berkeley student died from a drug overdose. Okay. He ingested a drug, and we don't know what it was. One thing we do know, it was a drug, grandmother told San Francisco outlet. And it goes on, and this is the tragic part. Again, his grandmother they're quoting here. He was just getting started on the second semester of his freshman year at UC Berkeley, majoring in math. Okay, so this guy's not, he's not there, you know, he's studying math. He's a serious student, and he was truly loving it. That's terrible, but it goes to show, yeah, you know, you're not. I don't care how much money you have, and Susan Wojcicki's net worth is about $750 million, if I'm reading estimates correctly, and her son's dead from a drug overdose.
So, the first thing I thought when I saw this headline was what Bill Moyer said: the problem with thinking anything goes is anything can come back to bite you, and. You know, I hate to say this, YouTube has been part of contributing to dishonest maps. They have gone way out of their way to make sure people don't have good maps of reality. And that has contributed to a system which is predatory to our children. And whatever happened to this young man, you know, it came from that lawlessness and that predatory infrastructure.
Yep.
And this is why I keep saying we're all on the menu. There's no people who think they're not on the menu or their money can protect them. Your money can't protect you from this.
Yeah, right. YouTube was a big part of, and media in general was a big part of pushing the pandemic, the scare story, like, oh my God, this COVID virus is terrible. And one of the ways they did it was by shunting deaths that were clearly from the opioid epidemic into the COVID column.
Right.
And it was a serious problem. So rather than to address the serious problem, you're leveraging the serious problem. And now the problem has come back, and it's real close to home.
So one thing I'll say, one of the scariest books I ever read was China RX, about pharmaceutical drugs in China, the ingredients were being made in China because they were, it was cheaper because they didn't have to do the quality control that we had to do in the United States. So you could cut corners. And of course, what was happening was people were taking the United States and dying.
Yeah.
Because they would poison people. You know, so this could have been a prescription drug. It didn't have to be fentanyl or some of the, you know, the things that kids take that can sometimes kill them. You don't know. I'm just saying this gets back to the whole deterioration throughout the system. And I am still stunned to see how many people believe their stock portfolio is going to protect them from this. And I don't understand it. Number one diminution of family wealth is caused by poisoning in this country. It's not caused by getting a poor return in your portfolio. It's caused by your kids and you being poisoned, whether it's by fluoride or whatever killed this young man.
Right. Yeah. A big medical issue in a family, that's a life-altering event, potentially, if it's big enough and expensive enough.
So I want you to sit down, if you are the mother or a father, if you run a family, I want you to sit down and I want you to put together a plan on how you are going to protect your family from the grape poisoning.
Yeah.
You need a plan. You need active action to protect yourself from the grape poisoning, because this environment is actively coming you with multiple ways of poisoning you. That's just reality. Anyway.
Yep. You got that right. And on that, and there's a lot of ways to do it too. Let's go to the next story in Farmageddon, which is really a graph from the World Bank. This is unbelievable, this graph. Life expectancy at birth, total years, North America. I'm going to just take this graph at face value. And you see the big drop off here. So I don't know if you can see this, but in North America in 2019, life expectancy was 79. Okay. Go forward a year. And now in 2020, it drops 2 years and it just kept on dropping, still 77. But that was a drop. And I guess my question is, if you go from 2019 to 2020 and you drop 2 years, the question is, did lockdowns and did loneliness cut into life expectancy that much? Because in that time frame, there was no vaccine.
I've spent a lot of time looking with Denny Rancor at what at the all-cause mortality and what was causing, you know, drops in all-cause mortality. I've also spent a lot of time looking at the ground and what's been causing it in certain age. You know, in certain income groups, you've had steady drop in life expectancy. It doesn't show up in those numbers because they're aggregate.
Right.
And I've concluded that it is literally impossible to nail down statistically what is doing what, because there are so many elements coming in that are causing people to be sick. And so, you know, I can speculate. I have theories of what's causing it. I think the pandemic pushed, you know, all the lockdowns and all the different things done, whether it was destroying your business, destroying your income, locking you up in your house, cutting you off from other people, you know, not letting you go to church, you know, all these different things were designed to produce this result. I think this is totally planned and intentional.
Yeah. And so would you agree? I mean, like if I had to bet money on what was the biggest contributor to that decline in mortality between 2019 and 2020, I would put it on the lockdowns. No doubt about it in my mind. I think they were devastating, and I don't think it's discussed nearly enough.
If lockdowns include destruction of income and businesses, then
yes.
Yeah.
Right. If you could trace it directly, approximately to lockdowns, yeah. But right. For the lockdown, your business would have been fine. That's a lockdown problem. Yes.
I agree. But I also think that poisoning in the spray and in the food and in the vaccines and the flu shots, you know, I had a major contributing factor.
Right. So, but those things, you mentioned flu vaccines and spray, those things have been going on since before 2019. Something changed between 19 and 20. And for my money, it's those lockdowns.
Right. Although, you know, I have to say, if I step back and look at the big picture, you know, I would say the number one cause of that drop was mind control, was people believing in the narrative.
Yeah.
People who didn't believe the narrative did much better than the people who didn't. So
for sure. Yeah. Right. But mind control that wasn't born in 2020. It wasn't. It's been around a long time.
Right.
And the narrative was a big part of it. But again, you can buttonhole it to lockdowns. That's right. The problem.
But I've never seen the mind control as bad. You know, it went to a whole new level during that period.
Yep.
And it bought people into stuff that made no sense. They really bought the Kool-Aid.
Yeah, they really did. I mean, I looked and saw, okay, the one I was like rolling my eyes over was going into the supermarket. I was living in Chicago, going there, and there's these stickers on the floor, the 6 feet spacing stickers, and they're everywhere. That's a... That's not just some decal on a window. Those are heavy-duty industrial stickers
that
require a lot of energy and a lot of heavy-duty printing equipment to do. And they're everywhere. There's millions and hundreds of millions across the country. It's like this thing has clearly been planned.
Right.
These things didn't. There's not a factory sitting there in Kansas, like just hey, you know what? Time to fire up the factory and print 300 million stickers overnight.
I'll never forget a doctor calling me and saying it was like a week after the first round of lockdowns. He said, "We have an inventory of masks, you know, that had to have been ordered before this all started."
Right.
And you're not going to believe this. They're all from China.
Yeah. Yeah. Suddenly, the warehouse gates open and there's all these stickers and masks and all this equipment. Like this had to have taken months, if not years, to produce this much in goods.
It's like the airports. I told you the airport story.
Mm.
From 96 on. All the airports around the United States were being out to be shopping malls. And I said, nobody's going to go to the airport to shop. Why would anybody, you go immediately to the gate, you get on the plane and you don't shop.
Right.
And then 9/11 happened and everybody had to be at the airport 2 hours ahead. And so you go shop.
Right.
And I thought they knew in 1996. That this was going to go into
place. Same.
Right.
The infrastructure went into place before the event.
Right.
The event is just the punchline.
Right.
The groundwork is the years and years leading up to the event. That's why when I saw all the stickers, I was like, you want me to take this seriously?
Well, but
no.
Make an estimate. If a stock is trading at 20 times earnings, okay, how much can you generate in the stock market from requiring people to hang out at the airport for 2 hours if you turn the airport into a shopping mall? Remember, the taxpayers pay for the shopping mall, right?
Right. Well, if the time goes from 20 minutes to 240 minutes, from 20 minutes to 2 hours, that's a big increase, right? That's a 12 times increase.
Right.
So you don't need a huge PE.
Right. So taxpayers pay, then they have to hang out for 2 hours, and then you get the stock market pop.
Right.
Made a fortune. Right. It's a big deal.
Okay. I want to go to another part of the pandemic story and a part of kind of the vaccine story. This is an interesting story. And I don't remember covering on Money and Markets before. I think this is a first. This is very curious. This is from the UK. From a publication called The Conservative Woman, even though it's written by a guy. The mystery of the phantom COVID jabs on my NHS record, so National Health Service record. I've never received any COVID vaccine, yet my NHS vaccination record states that I had one dose of Pfizer here, I had another dose of Pfizer there, I had a bivalent booster on October 15th at yet a third location. What's going on? So this guy looks into it and says, in each case, after investigating the matter, the vaccination site told me, in essence, that the data is the data. And while not actually calling me a liar, suggested I might be mistaken. They're saying, well, you're full of it. It's a record. And he says, when he looked at the record, consent was said on the record to have been given by me verbally and recorded by staff at these various vaccination sites. And he said, I never consented. I never got the vaccinations. And he says, on the records, I do not recognize the phone numbers entered on the form. So this data is just made up. And his question is this widespread? I urge anyone unvaccinated to check their vaccination records. And I would include people in the U.S. because the vaccination, the whole thing with the pandemic was monkey see, monkey do across the Western world. So if it's going on in the U.K., it's going on in the U.S. too. No question about that.
Right, but I'm not clear why. Why are they doing this?
Well, one reason might be to jimmy up the numbers and pressure people like, 80% of the country's got vaccination, don't be the freak.
Right.
And it's like, well, your numbers aren't that good. Another reason would be it dilutes the death data. You kill people with a vaccination. It's like, yeah, but that's one out of 100 million when it's really one out of 40 million.
Right. That's a very good point. It does dilute the death data.
Yeah. I mean, not a lot, but every little bit helps. So it helps you on the marketing on the upside, and it dilutes the okay. All right, I want to go to one last story in Farmageddon to wrap it up. And this explains, I think, a lot in the what's going on in Ukraine. This is just a Twitter post from someone. I've got a link in the description box or a link in the PDF. Disturbing story.
I can't get RT. I can't get RT here, and I can't get RT in the Netherlands. It's blocked.
Well, I got it here. I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yeah, well, I'll try it. Now that I'm in the United States, I'll try it more.
Here, I'll show you. Okay, let's just go to the story. This is just a Twitter post. Disturbing for the story out of Ukraine by RT. In Mariupol, there have been bioweapons labs testing on Ukrainian children. Orphaned. The testing has been going on since 2014, testing on kids. All of Big Pharma were there. Pfizer, AstraZeneca, et cetera, with rumors of murder and cover-ups. And here you can see the story, and I've got, I'm pretty sure I have,
That it has found evidence suggesting that Western pharmaceutical companies have been carrying out drug trials on Ukrainians for nearly a decade. Even newborns were said to have been involved. Now, this all allegedly took place following the 2014.
So my point in that is that you, if you're interested, you can look at the RT story right in that Twitter.
Right. So if you don't believe this kind of thing goes on, read Kennedy's book on Fauci. And it tells Celia Farber's investigative reports on inhuman testing with children, orphan children in the United States. It's one of the hardest, ugliest things I've ever read. And wow. What's going on in the Ukraine? I am 100% certain. I absolutely, the constant reports about what was going on with the bio laboratories. And then we showed Victoria Nuland's testimony when she's squirming around, trying not to admit what they were up to with the
right.
And as we know, the neocons, one of the neocons' plans of what they're depending on is, you know, biowarfare, you know, with labs all around the world using to terrorize people.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I had forgotten about the Nuland testimony, but her body language gives her away. That's definitely what they were up to.
Right. So the Russians have a lot of information about this.
Yeah.
And the question is, how are they going to dribble? They keep dribbling it out. And the question is, how are they going to dribble it out?
Right. Right. But anyway, there's no doubt that what they're showing there with the biolab testing and testing on the kids in Ukraine in 2014, that's the tip of a nasty, nasty iceberg. Everything I've read about Ukraine is it's the powers that be criminal cesspool.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's the back room of the police station where they...
You wake up one day and you're on the wrong team.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's switch gears to pushback. This first story, right up our alley, right up our alley. Why are more people using small banks and credit unions? Well, I'll just tell you now, they don't really answer the question here, but let's go to the story. Credit unions grew their share of primary credit cards from 6% in 2020 to 8.3% in 2023, while community banks more than doubled theirs from 2.3% to 5.1% in the same time period. So those are big increases, not small. In addition, one in four survey participants, so 25% of people answering the survey, said they are more likely to use either a credit union or a community bank for their next credit card application. Why are people moving? Like I said, they don't really answer it. It's lower fees. It's all this stuff that all existed way before the time period in question. The question is, why are people moving to community banks now? Why small banks now? The article doesn't answer that.
We're talking about credit cards, but I think the reason they're moving their credit cards is they're also moving their accounts. They don't seem to mention that.
Right. Right. It could be. I mean, It's all the things that we've talked about, you know. Knowing your banker is safe, when people see the story with big banks,
right?
They know what's going on, and it's having an effect. You know, people, we're getting smarter as we go along. We're getting smarter as we go along, and people are smarter about the media suppressing stories and trying to push a point of view. And the too big to fail banks, they're losing favor, and people are sick of it, and they're moving to smaller banks.
Well, they want a bank who knows them and they know the bank. And so you have that relationship that can handle problems. And the last thing they want, I mean, I talked about it last week, but I have never encountered as much fraud in customer service and customer dealing as I have with hotels, planes, car rental, you know, all these different arrangements. They are, you know, you are dealing with I'm convinced their algorithms say, okay, John Titus values his time at this much per hour. So we can jack these charges this much without putting him in a position where he can afford to really come after it. It's just cheaper to pay it than to fight it. And they've got algorithm, and then they pad the bills accordingly.
Yeah.
I absolutely believe the algorithms are doing that.
That wouldn't surprise me. I'd be surprised if they weren't doing that.
Anyway, People want a bank they can talk to.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Okay, let's quickly go to the next story. I just want to touch the headline. Telegraph from the UK, exercise twice as effective as antidepressants. Yeah, no kidding. Imagine that.
Especially banking.
But that's I put that in pushback though, because it's like, here's what you can do personally.
Right.
You want to push back? Go out and exercise.
Right.
Get up to throw these medications away. Get out of the big pharma prison, and take control. Do something. You know, help yourself.
So my bike in Hickory Valley. You know, my house is being repainted, and I can use it again shortly. And but the bike I have, you have to clean in. So I want to get a bike that's, you know, no cleaning in. So I'm going to get one of your Marin bikes, the one you got.
That's a good bike. I took it in recently for a series of flat tires. I'm like, why am I getting flat tires all of a sudden? Finally, I said, listen, you got to look. And they did. And they looked through the tire. And it's like I had run over a nail.
Right.
And it was sticking through the tire. And it was they didn't see it. They kept putting inner tubes in.
Anyway. You know, you can learn how to change your own inner tube. I had to do it to ride across.
That's where I am. Like, okay. And one of the problems in Raleigh is there's a lot of interruptions now and construction projects on the path. And the detours tend to take you through some big intersections.
Right.
And that, I'm convinced that's where I'm picking up the nails. You know.
So anyway. It was Marin bikes, but it was Larkspur, right?
Yeah, the Larkspur 2. I think there's a 3 out now. It's a good bike.
Okay.
It's a beefy bike. It's a heavy bike, though. Let me warn you, it's a steel bike. I think it weighs around 45 pounds. Then I load it down with camera gear. I think the damn thing's like 60 pounds. It's a workout. Just
okay. Well, I'll test drive it. I do it.
It's a workout. Yeah, it's a good one, though.
I'm not cleaning in anymore, so I need a new bike.
Yeah. Okay. Let's keep it going and push back. This next story is big. This isn't so much pushback as the effective pushback for the New York Post. J.P. Morgan, BlackRock drop out of massive U.N. climate alliance in stunning move. Yeah, you color me stunned. Chase and BlackRock, they're quitting, or in the case of BlackRock, substantially scaling back involvement in a massive U.N. climate alliance formed to combat global warming through corporate sustainability agreements. J.P. Morgan says it's because of the expansion of its in-house sustainability team, so they don't need the U.N. They're doing it in-house. BlackRock and State Street, by contrast, said the alliance's climate initiatives have gone too far. So regardless, however you want to cut it, those bigger banks are getting out of.
No, it's really simple. Vanguard left, and now they're getting all the state business. Do you know what I mean? The
market
is blocking these guys, and they got to switch. Thank you,
right.
Red states. Thank you.
Right. That's the effective pushback.
UAGs, thank you. Don't tell me the states don't have power. They do.
Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. Let's keep it going. Another pushback case, again, from CHD. We always have a daily double, I guess, on money and markets. And this week, it's Children's Health Defense with the second story. Kennedy and CHD win injunction and landmark censorship case against Biden administration. A federal judge on Wednesday handed RFK Jr. and Children's Health Defense a partial win in their landmark censorship case, alleging the Biden administration colluded with social media platforms to unlawfully censor online content. This should sound familiar since we've talked about that before, and we've talked about this guy before. Judge Terry Doughty of the U.S. court for the Western District of Louisiana issued a preliminary injunction against the Biden administration, but he also issued a stay on the injunction until 10 days after the U.S. Supreme Court rules on a similar case, Murphy versus Missouri. Now, that probably sounds unfamiliar, but I must point out that case was originally filed as Missouri versus Biden, which we covered on this show. So what's going on? The Supreme Court is set to hear arguments in this Missouri versus Biden, now Murphy versus Missouri, on March 18th. So Daugherty's going to wait to rule. But the significance of this case is that the judge, Daugherty, decided that standing in RFK and in CHG's favor. Standing means, I think a lot of, there's some doubt about whether you can truly claim that you were injured.
Right.
You're the injured party by Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And Daugherty's saying, yeah, you can.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's going to open, if that stands up, that's going to open a sluice gate of lawsuits against the Biden administration.
There can't be too many.
Can't be too many.
We have to win on the First Amendment.
Right. So big props to Kennedy for bringing that lawsuit and prevailing. And you know, yeah, he's piggybacking on Missouri versus Biden, but that's exactly what the kind of thing you need to do.
Right. I also want to say Missouri versus Biden, another example, the state AGs. That was the state AG in Missouri and Louisiana. And the more the state AGs and treasurers and legislatures push back, the better off we're going to be.
Yeah, right, right. You got it. Anyway, that's it for pushback this week. Well, that's it for pushback stories. You want to go to subscriber comments?
Yeah, so I keep saying the best intelligence we get is subscribers writing in and say, here's what happened on the ground. And we have a couple of emails that were just very informative this week.
Yeah. So I'll read one. Actually read a couple. I've got them up on my screen so I can just read them. This is about the Kansas City Chiefs and the shooting there. I have a short observation and comment with regards to the event at the Kansas City Chiefs victory rally held at Grand Central Station, Kansas City, on Valentine's Day. I and my wife were in attendance during the alleged shooting, and within 3 to 5 minutes of the occurrence, we were within 50 feet of the event location, and I saw nobody on the ground or suffering from wounds, nor did I see anybody calling for help for their loved ones who were shot. In fact, we were in a sea of people making our way out of the park in an orderly fashion. It reminded me of going to a jam-packed venue during my college days. As we made our way to the road exiting the park, we did see two men in their early 20s handcuffed and under arrest, and we saw another in a gator-type vehicle bleeding possibly from a fall as a result from a pursuit. In no way did I feel threatened or at risk, and I was surprised to see all the drama unfold on local broadcasts. During the initial moments of the event, we did observe a lot of people moving toward the stage area, and we thought it was due to the crowd wanting something free from stage participants. I did observe approximately 8 sniper-type men on various rooftops. Interesting. 2 drones hovering over the crowd and a Hughes 500D helicopter patrolling overhead all during the time between 10 a.m. through the end of the presentations. That's really, really interesting.
Well, you see, you know, the reports from on the ground are completely different than the reports you get in the media, and you begin to realize, okay, the media is just entertainment.
Yes, yes. It's a lot of this appears to be staged, would it not?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crisis actors? Question mark?
Yeah. And like, really? There was 8 sniper guys in a parade? Where did they come from? Anyway, that's a really interesting comment.
You know, you see scores of these events all year, and if you deep dive any one of them, you could spend hundreds of hours trying to figure out what really went on. But ultimately, what you realize, that's not a good investment of the time. All you need to know is everything you read in the media is not reliable.
No, right, right. It's all unreliable.
Right.
All of it. I'm convinced that that one of the main functions of having weather in sports is so that people can verify, yes, that sports score matches up with what I saw, and the temperature does jive with what I see, to give the rest of the story's credibility.
Exactly. So one of the things, what happened to me in 2000, I used to be a subscriber to Reader's Digest service, where you get You can have, say, you get a subscription and they'll give you 10 magazines and you keep changing them. So I would go through hundreds of different worlds. So, you know, I'd go through a Catholic phase or a weightlifting phase or an RV phase to try and dip in and understand these different niches and worlds. It was fascinating. But my, you know what my favorite magazine was? Country Home. You know why I love Country Home? Because there were no lies in it. Wow. A magazine that doesn't lie to you. It's great. You know, on any story where they would lie to you, they just don't run that story. And when they talk about, you know, how to put drapes up, they don't lie.
Yeah.
It was great to just sit down with one magazine that didn't lie.
My favorite magazine of all time was Highlights, because they had What's Wrong with This Picture, which at the back of it. And they had a cartoon called Goofus and Gallant. And to contrast socially acceptable and unacceptable behavior, it was quite illuminating. But now, Highlights has ruined Goofus and Gallant because they can no longer have Goofus be that bad.
Right.
He's borderline nice now. It's pathetic. It's really annoying. Anyway, let's go to the second comment. This is from a subscriber who's heard various comments about things going on in Greece, about CBDC and cash, who writes, among other things, that since the 1st of January of this year in Greece, you cannot buy anything over 500 euros paying in cash. If you do, you get a fine. The fine is double the amount of the receipt. So if you buy something that is worth 600 euros and you pay in cash and the IRS catches that, you'll be fined with 1,200 euros. For amounts over 500 euros, you must pay with credit card or transfer the money to the shop owner's account. Wow. So the war on cash is on.
The war on cash, you know, the war for an all-digital system is on, and that has to be resisted at all costs. Can't let that happen.
And that's a great comment, too, to sort of keep your eye on the ball. Cash is so important in this, because if the cash, you got to protect the cash, because without the cash, it's all digital, right?
Right.
As you point out, checks are very important too.
Yes.
But cash is super important too. Focus on that.
Are an open clearing system. And right. That's why if you have checks and checks are going and you have cash, you can't lock it down and you can't close it off. And in theory, a state could run a cash netting and closing system on an open basis if it had to in an emergency that stops anybody from outside this jurisdiction to shutting it down.
Right. In other words, I can go to my neighbor and buy whatever with check or cash, with check just as well as with cash.
Right. Yeah. I told you the story of the subscriber reported the problem they had getting through their check cashing. They wanted to order more checks and they couldn't get through. This was last October. And so they finally got through and they said, what's going on? And they said, we're really sorry. We're working overtime and trying to train and hire new people. We just have such a demand for checks. But it's very time consuming because a lot of the people who are ordering them have never used them and they want to understand how to use them.
Yeah.
That's a good sign.
It is. Checks aren't quite as good as cash, though, because the check's got to clear. And with AI in the mix now, maybe it clears, maybe it doesn't if you buy something, you know. So cash is king, but, you know, checks are very important too.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. Okay, let us now turn to charts. And we'll start with the U.S. dollar index.
We're going to do Universal Music.
Well, the problem is...
Can I just tell what happened?
Yeah, go ahead.
So you and I were talking about overbilling by AT&T. Last week we recorded, and right after I hung up from the record, my phone rings, and normally I don't have it on, but I needed the hotspot for the recording, and it said Universal Music New York, and I knew that would be a robocall of some kind, and I answered it. So this was, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes after you and I talked about the overbilling by AT&T, and it was someone in a customer service setting wanting to know if they could help me with my problems on my AT&T account. So I said, which AT&T account is that? At which point they hung up.
Wow.
So
they just hung up on you.
Yeah, they just hung up. Because they realized they had no documentation of me having an AT&T account. Their call was inspired by the surveillance.
So they were fishing. They wanted you to give them the information. But to be clear, you were talking to a live human being, right?
Yes, I was talking to a live human being. And it didn't sound like they were necessarily in the United States. It could have been Guatemala. But but basically, their call was inspired by, you know, a software screening what you and I were saying. So they assumed, you know, the surveillance assumes that we have an AT&T account because we're talking about AT&T accounts, but they have no documentation
right.
of an AT&T account. You know, that would be too, you know, why bother?
Right. It's easier to have somebody call you and have you give them the information rather than dig it up.
Yeah. Right.
Totally lawless. But also far from the most disturbing example of illicit surveillance that I could think of. And I can talk about those another time.
Oh, absolutely.
They're listening to everything. And when I say everything, I mean even things you think they might not be able to hear.
Right.
They're hearing.
Right. And every ounce of information is used to extract value in whatever way they can get it to extract value. So.
Yep. You got it. There's been instances where I've had my phone in my back pocket and have said something and they're listening.
Yeah. 100%. There's a great Italian movie called The Listening that came out early. It's sort of mid-90s about how they can listen to everything and anything.
Wow. Yeah. Anyway, that's funny because it was on, you know, we're recording a show and they're listening. It's just like, guys, it's just totally unfiltered. It's everything. Okay, let's go to charts now, starting with U.S. dollar index year to date.
Okay, so as the J.P. Morgan Chase analyst predicted, dollar continues dominant. So, you know, it's losing trade market share slowly, but it continues to be dominant, and we're clearly on an upswing. And I think one of the big questions before us is, will the Fed have to raise interest rates to defend the dollar? But, you know, right now it's strong.
Yeah, right now they're fine. And I don't think they're going to raise. But anyway, we'll see. This one is really interesting. Wow.
So, I continue to talk about the plunder economy. And if you look at the train tracks of the plunder economy really revved up as soon as you got the satellites flying up. And Lockheed Martin, of course, is the number one player it's the number one U.S. defense contractor in getting the satellites up. But if you look at the train tracks of building the control grid, you know, Lockheed Martin is a major player on the government and satellite and space side, and then J.P. Morgan Chase, major player on the financial side. And so if you look at the control grid, they're major parts of the infrastructure. And they're not doing any near as well as the guys who rake off the equity, you know, that dances on that infrastructure. So if you look at the kind of surveillance you and I were just talking about, we have Google. So we just talked about the YouTube.
Yeah.
You have Google who's helping to build those train tracks, and that takes the data that you get from the J.P. Morgan and Lockheed train tracks and it converts it into something that money people can use. So let's look at the money people. You have BlackRock, you know, significantly ahead of the infrastructure guys, except for big tech flying. Then you have Carlyle up 94%. And again, this is from when they voted on the going direct reset, but then KKR flying. So KKR and Carlyle are the leveraged buyout guys. But essentially what this says is disaster capitalism, you know, is what dances, you know, when you talk about equity investors making money from disaster capitalism, here it is. I wish I had a line for Harvard Endowment, because if you look at the guys financing KKR and Carlyle, you know, they're the ones who are ultimately getting often the most leverage. And I hate to say this, this includes a lot of state and other governmental pension funds who are following along. So if you want to know who's making money on the disaster capitalism, a lot of us are financing it. But this is just sort of shows you what the plunder economy looks like.
Yeah, it's kind of a convenient, handy-dandy ranking there.
Right. Anyway. You add big tech to the basic infrastructure, and it's the guys who claw out the equity who are making the big returns. But
there's problem. There's Google right there.
Right. Big tech. Yeah. There's no doubt that big tech is making big returns.
Yeah.
But the message keeps, and we'll see it on the next one when we look at stock markets around the world. The message on this says the going direct reset is working for the people who are doing it.
Yeah, for sure. And let's go to the next one. Here you go.
You know, I would love to have a chart of the life expectancies of the people who work at those companies.
You don't want the previous chart?
Yep. Okay. Yeah. So this is simply, since the going direct reset was voted on, this is the S&P. VGK is the European ETF, and FXI is China. Right. So you can see, you know, S&P flying, Europe lagging seriously. So we talked earlier about Europe being composted to help the U.S. And then, of course, China in the, you know, in the doghouse. But interestingly enough, so gold up 30%. So gold was certainly a solid investment during that period.
Yeah, outperforming Lockheed by 3-1.
Yep. And but the long treasury in the doghouse because of the interest rate, you know, what's happening with interest rates. So here's what's interesting. If you think in your mind of that plunder chart we just looked at,
yeah,
the thing that's financing all of that, the thing that is pumping all the profits into all those companies, is basically government subsidy. I mean, this is a highly, you know, it's subsidized with government money and government rules.
Well, it's subsidized by the sovereign power of money creation.
Right.
It was used in favor of non-banks and of certain companies like BlackRock, to be sure.
But if you look at this chart that we're looking at.
Yeah.
Okay. How long are investors going to lose 36% so that they can finance KKR getting rich?
Not very, which is why the Fed's going to step in, and the Fed could step in and buy those bonds itself. All you have to do is flick of the pen, change the law, and the Fed buys the treasuries directly.
Not without inflation.
No, without inflation, they can do that. Yep.
Okay, that's going to be a longer conversation. But what I'm saying is, the more you pour subsidy into one sector at the expense of another sector, at some point, the political equation, the chickens are going to come home to roost. And that's what's happening in all the stories we're seeing.
Oh, yeah. Next up, we have interest rate.
Okay, so this is the Fed funds rate since August 2019. And what you can see is you drop rates, everybody pours and picks up debt, and then you jack rates up.
And that's a long time, too. That's from March of 2020. To February of 2022, that's a long time to lull people to sleep.
That's when you have the SPAC and crypto pump, right? But God knows how many people were taking on more debt. And then wham, everybody's in the debt trap. So one of the things that's been interesting as I talk to state legislators from states that have very little debt to states that are just swimming in debt, the guys who are swimming in debt are having an impossible time getting anything done.
Yeah, I bet.
And you see how important it is to stay out of the debt trap, whether it's a person or a state. So anyway.
I mean, that is a big time ramp right there from, you know, in the space of a little bit over.
It's the fastest the Fed has ever gone up that I can find.
That had to have burned a lot of people. No doubt about that. I mean, let's put it this way. You see this rise here? Okay. Right. That 5.5% rise took a lot less time than that rate stayed at zero.
Right.
Yep.
But the other thing is, when you look at that kind of rise, that's a killer. I mean, that kills people.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Anyway. Okay. Next graph we got, I believe, is FinViz.
Yep. Anyway, so now cocoa is taking the lead against orange juice. Wow.
Yep, and we're back to our wallpaper with VIX in the good old basement there.
Right. I never get over that one. But what you see is, you know, there are signs of growing inflation. And you certainly see it out here on the road. Traveling around, the price increases are stunning.
Yeah, they are. They're big time price increases everywhere.
Last week, we talked about, you know, Americans running out of savings.
Uh-huh.
I have no idea when the savings number hits zero. If, you know, you said it had probably hit zero by now. I don't know. But that's what it feels like. And as you know, as it drops below zero, that's where the chickens really come home to roost.
Yeah, well, we had seen it drop from $2 trillion to $190 billion, which is a 90% drop. Not going to take it long to get from $190 billion to zero on that trajectory. But that's, and like you say, that's going to be a real problem. But let's go to our most interesting, for my money, the most interesting chart of the week from Visual Capitalist. Here it is, oil. And so to sort of set the goalposts here, this chart begins in 1992 and goes through 2022. And it's basically the price of how oil is doing in different countries. Crude oil production in the world.
It's production.
Yeah, production. Look at that. Look at that chart. So it bottoms out in the global financial crisis 2008 for the U.S., which is weird because oil that had peaked out at $144 a barrel that summer 2008. It bottoms out there, and QE starts, and that gets back the U.S. back in the production game.
So my feedback from the oil patch, which is anecdotal, you know, it's not a large survey, but throughout this period is that central banks are printing and throwing money on a wholly uneconomic basis. You know, you're paying double for a barrel of oil, you know, what you can sell it for. And they are basically printing and throwing money and attributing this explosive rise, not to the tsunami of central bank money, but to the tsunami of fracking and new technology. So I told you, you know, I think AI is a cover story for a tsunami of money being essentially gifted to certain sectors. And it felt the same thing. They were saying fracking, fracking, fracking. But if you really looked at what was going on in the oil patch, it was just money being thrown at creating production volume.
Yeah.
So whatever that was, it was highly economic. I'm not saying, you know, the U.S. hasn't surpassed Russia as oil producer, but what they paid for it was astonishing.
Right. But your point is that fracking was a cover story, and now we got the AI cover story. Fracking covering, you know, the money printing, among other things. AI to me is a cover story for, you know what, we can blame it on AI. So whatever problems we had, we execute these people, just blame it on AI and machines going bonkers because the AI algorithm went schizoid on us. And it's just for sure. Another angle on that cover story with AI is you're powerless against AI. Don't even try. Don't learn how to paint. There's no point in learning, taking a math course now. AI is just so smart. You just sit on your couch and be passive.
So part of it is when you deal with a car rental company, when you deal with a hotel, when you deal with making a plane reservation, the person that you're dealing, the human that you're dealing with has almost no power. So they can't explain the charges. They can't explain the terms and conditions. They can't explain why you're paying that amount. They can't explain. All they can do is take your complaints and tell you there's nothing you can do. You have to call this customer service number, you know, between the hours of 9 to 5, you know, and you'll sit on hold for hours if you think you're going to get through. So, yeah. So they're there to mollify you. They're not there to really do anything.
Yeah.
So it's a control game. And that way you can pay them very little because they're just there to, you know, they're there to manage your temper as you get upset.
Yeah, they're there to babysit. That's a baby. You're paying a babysitter's rate instead of a customer's. Yeah.
They're babysitters. Perfect. Right. Okay.
Yeah, baby's diaper is wet, and you got to sit there and coddle the baby until we can kick it over. Yeah.
Right. But they don't understand anything about the business. That's all done by the systems. And they don't make any sense. You get charges, and nobody can explain what the charge is, what it describes, why it's justified.
Right. They're not a million years, as babysitter going to be able to tell you that.
Right.
Okay, that wraps up the external portion of our show, which is most of the show. And now we turn in-house to Solaria. You ready?
Yep.
All right. Grassroots food series.
Yeah, so the food, one of the things I've learned when I go out to the state or local level, you always want to make sure the money and financial people hook up with the food people, because the food people, you know, are ahead of the game in terms of really getting things done at the state and local level. But this the interview this week is Pete Kennedy, who runs the food series, doing something on grassroots activism. And, you know, if you want to get something done at state and local level, this is a good one for you. And Pete Kennedy was the person who first hooked us up with many of the Tennessee legislators who are getting amazing things done, because the guys getting things done in the money area are getting things done in the food area. And that's good, because, you know, if you're going to preserve freedom with the money, you got to preserve freedom with the food.
Yeah, not going to do your money. It's not going to do you much good if you're starved to death.
If you're poisoned. We didn't cover it, but did you read that article about they're feeding garbage to crickets? And if they can get the crickets to eat the garbage without dying, then they can feed us the crickets.
Yeah, no, I didn't read that.
Good. I'll send that one to you. That's really.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to the retro hero of the week. What do we got?
So I love this story. I found out about this story from Senator Nicely. So George Washington, towards the end of the Revolutionary War, said, quote, "All hope is lost," and announced that we had lost the war. And then the Battle of King Mountain happened. And what happened was there was a group of settlers in North Carolina and Eastern Tennessee, and the British had roughed them up pretty badly, and they went over the mountain and moved to Tennessee, Appalachia. So they went over the Appalachian Mountains. And then what happened was they decided to come back over the mountain and help Washington, his army. They won the Battle of King Mountain, and that helped win the war. And the leader of the Overmountain Men was John Sevier, who was the founder of Tennessee and was governor 6 times and congressman 4 times. Just an amazing guy. He won 35 out of 35 battles. Anyway, so he's our hero of the week. And there's a wonderful film company called Shiloh Films that they're making a trilogy about the story of the Overmountain Men. And they've done the first two, and they're still doing the one on the Battle of King Mountain, which I look forward to getting. But and one of our movies last week was one of the Shiloh films. So it's a very interesting story, and it underscores the fact when it comes to freedom, it's never over till it's over. And if you look at the history of freedom, again and again, it looks hopeless, and then something shows up. And
the hour is darkest right before dawn.
Exactly. So, you know, never. That's why I say never quit. Never quit.
Yep. Okay. Shiloh Films, good for them. Let's keep it going with the many phases of mind control.
So we had a great interview last week with Elsa von Hellen doing Michelle Stiles on her book about propaganda. And we got a lot of questions about propaganda, disinformation, mind control. And we decided we'd put up a little commentary, because there's so many aspects to tricking people, about giving people a fake map. You know, there's disinformation, there's dirty tricks, there's propaganda, there's entrainment, there's subliminal programming, there's, you know, it's a wide portfolio of things. And we decided once again to pull together a commentary that provides the links to all sorts of collections and interviews we've done on this topic. And I continue to believe this is one of the most important obstacles facing families who try to protect themselves from the great poisoning or financial control. You know, you want to, you want your mind to be clear, coherent, and you want to be taking information and using that information in your own self-interest or as you choose to, and not getting tricked. mean, I've been stunned sitting at the state legislatures about, you know, all the tricks that are going on, whether it's the campaign around the grade taking or some of these other things. People are getting tricked and it's wasting enormous amounts of time and resources.
Yeah, so, no doubt about that. There's a lot of that going on right now. I've noticed that myself. Like, wow. Now, a ton of bogeymen out there. You can't waste your time shadow boxing just a contrivance.
Real strategic thinking to do that. I mean, during the day, I find myself constantly, you know, when I get online, I find myself constantly getting.
I remind myself a dozen times a day, don't take the bait.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, let's wrap up with the final and most important in-house matter of the week. That is the meet and greet schedule.
So if subscribers come to the website, log in, and you'll immediately get a panel for the meet and greet schedule. We're keeping it updated. And of course, the highlight, the next one up, I'm going to Pittsburgh and then Raleigh, and John Titus will be there.
We'll be there. That's right down the street. So after we're done, we're going to go down the street where I was to my junior high school.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'd just been kicked out. Nah, not kicked out. I'd come from private schools. A joint agreement between my parent and the private school is where I discovered my extreme distaste for abusive authority. And so it came to pass that I ended up in public schools. And my second one was East Millbrook, which is right down the street from that venue.
So can I ask what private school it was?
Yes, St. Timothy's. Okay. I was there from first through fifth grade, and fifth grade was that's why me and my fifth grade team, we duked it out, and I lost. But we went at it the whole year, and then finally, at the end of the year, it's like, yeah, you gotta go.
So I went to Quaker school, and every year I would ask my parents if I could leave and go to boarding school, and every year I would have to go back to Friends Select. And I want you to know, John, at Friends Select, they would kick out the fifth quintile every year you'd be asked to leave. And my goal was always to be the last person in the fourth quintile.
Yeah.
So when I graduated, my understanding was I was last in the class. And when we went through the line during the high school graduation ceremony, the principal was congratulating everybody. And then he got to me and he said, goodbye.
Really? Wow. Awesome.
Yeah. So I had a teacher who gave me trouble about my skirts, the length of my skirts. So and it was funny because my skirts were no shorter than, you know, half the other girls in the class. So I got this really old, ugly Harris tweed skirt that was like 5 inches longer than any skirt. And I wore it every day for 6 months, you know, and my excuse was, well, you wanted a long skirt. This is my long skirt. There you go.
There you go. Wow.
So I was not popular with the faculty.
I was not popular with my fifth grade teacher. We went at it. I tell you, at the front of the year, there was elections. The class size was 13. So in September of this year, 77, whenever it was, there's elections. I'm going to run for president of the class. And the teacher says, well, we got to have somebody to run. I want so-and-so to run. So we have an election. And by the way, since I'm 30 and you're 10, and I know more than you do, I'm going to vote too, but my vote counts 5, right? So now you got 18 votes. I got to win 10 of them to win the election, and I won 10 votes and was president of the class. And thus, the battle line was drawn in that class. And it was not good. And I wasn't the model student either, uh-huh. You know, but I wasn't going to – the tension in the valley went on the whole year, where finally at the end of the year, you had to wear uniforms at St. Timothy's, navy pants and white shirts. But on the last day of the class, last day of the school year, you got to wear your street clothes. It was a big deal. And the teacher said, no, everybody can wear their street clothes except for John. He's been bad all year. And my mom caught whiff of that. She's like, you're not doing that to my son. And I stayed home. But that was it for St. Timothy's. I was
– wow.
Next year I was out. Anyway.
Okay. We could tell early you were going to be a litigator.
I was going to be a truth teller, and I wasn't going to sit there and take it. Anyway, so the next year I was in a school called Millbrook, which is at that time, sixth grade, you were in elementary school. It was your last year of elementary school. And the following year I went to East Millbrook, which is on Spring Forest Road, right down the street from the venue for the March 2nd meet and greet from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m., where I will be.
So I think we have it up now. It looks like we're going to be, we've got one in Cincinnati that will add to the schedule. But if you check in on the schedule after you log in, you can see it. We're continually adding them as we go. And it's clear we're doing so many. I think I'm going to have to come back to the United States later in the year. Do many.
Okay. Yeah. Good for you. But will you be there in Raleigh?
What do you mean, will I be here in Raleigh?
Well, are you going to the meet and greet on March 2nd in Raleigh? Yes or no?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. There we go. Okay. I'll see you there. Because the next Money in Markets is not until after then.
I know. So
the next time I see you will be in person. Very cool.
It will. And then we will do our next Money in Markets 2 weeks from, as you would say, a fortnight, first week of March.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
A lot of chickens come home to roost before.
A whole lot of chickens coming home to roost by then.
Okay, John. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Slayer Report. Have a wonderful fortnight.